Miles Pudge Halter arrives at Culver Creek Preparatory School in Alabama with a strange obsession with famous last words and a yearning for what Francois Rabelais called the great perhaps. His social life back in Florida was so barren that his going away party consisted of exactly two people who spent most of the time ignoring him. At Culver Creek, he meets his roommate, the Colonel, a short, commanding figure with a photographic memory who immediately begins explaining the school's complex social hierarchy. But it's Alaska Young who truly captures Miles' attention. She bursts into his life like a hurricane, talking about boys who honked her breast over summer and proudly displaying her life's library, hundreds of books she's collecting to read before she dies. Beautiful, brilliant, unpredictable, and deeply troubled, Alaska becomes the center of Miles' universe almost instantly. Miles' initiation comes when he's duct-taped and thrown into a lake by the weekday warriors, wealthy students who go home on weekends while scholarship students like the Colonel stay behind. This incident cements his friendship with the Colonel, who declares Miles not just a roommate, but a friend, promising revenge with surprising intensity. In this world of teenage alliances and rivalries, Miles finally finds the belonging he's been searching for. Life at Culver Creek revolves around classes, secret cigarettes, and Miles' growing infatuation with Alaska. While French challenges him, Dr. Hyde's world religions class captivates him with discussions about escaping the labyrinth of suffering, a recurring theme throughout their experiences. Alaska remains an enigma, sometimes exuberant, other times melancholy. You spend your whole life stuck in the labyrinth, thinking about how you'll escape it one day, but you never do, she tells Miles. When he admits he sometimes doesn't understand her, she simply responds, "You never get me. That's the whole point." She sets Miles up with Lara, a Romanian student. Despite their disastrous first date, where Miles gets concussed and vomits on Lara's pants, Lara maintains interest in him. Alaska's contradictions become increasingly apparent. Brilliant yet self-destructive, caring yet manipulative, passionate yet deeply wounded, hinting at deeper traumas that will eventually surface. During Thanksgiving break, Miles bonds with Alaska while staying at school. They share wine, read Vonnegut, and when Miles attempts to kiss her, Alaska stops him with, "Don't ruin it," preserving their friendship while acknowledging their tension. Alaska teaches Miles to break into classmates' rooms. They visit the Colonel's tiny trailer home, giving Miles perspective on his resentment toward wealthy students. Their modest Thanksgiving dinner becomes meaningful when everyone shares gratitudes, with Alaska thankful for having just had my best Thanksgiving in a decade. During a drinking game called Best Day, Worst Day, Alaska reveals her childhood trauma. At age 8, she failed to call 911 when her mother had an aneurysm, watching helplessly as she died. "That's the worst day. I don't know why I didn't call 911," she confesses tearfully. "I was so scared and I didn't know what to do." This revelation explains Alaska's impulsivity, mood swings, and self-destructive tendencies, all stemming from this unprocessed trauma. After executing an elaborate prank against the weekday warriors involving firecrackers, hair dye, and hacked progress reports, Miles and his friends celebrate with alcohol. The evening starts with Miles and Lara spending awkward but sweet time together, receiving relationship advice from Alaska. During a drinking game, Alaska challenges Miles to kiss her, finally giving him the kiss he's been dreaming about for months. When she falls asleep beside him, Miles whispers, "I love you," though she doesn't hear him. The night shifts dramatically when Alaska awakens in distress, claiming she must urgently leave campus after a phone call. Despite her obviously impaired state, Miles and the Colonel help create a diversion with fireworks so she can drive away, tearful and intoxicated but insistent. This decision to help their drunk, distraught friend drive off campus becomes a source of profound regret, showing how teenagers often make significant decisions guided by emotion rather than careful consideration. The devastating news arrives the next morning. Alaska died instantly when she crashed into a police car, the steering wheel crushing her chest. The news divides Miles' world into before and after. Miles tries convincing himself it's just Alaska's prank, while the colonel breaks down screaming, "I'm so sorry," repeatedly. Their grief reflects their personalities. Miles retreats into denial. The colonel's emotions erupt uncontrollably. Grief manifests physically for both. The colonel embarks on a punishing 84-mile walk without sleep, returning shaking from exhaustion. Miles experiences nightmares where Alaska appears beautiful before transforming into a corpse, showing how grief inhabits both body and mind. At Alaska's funeral, they find her father kneeling before her closed coffin. Miles places his hands on the mahogany casket, the color of her hair, while the colonel whispers, "You deserved a better friend." This moment captures the regret that accompanies grief, the feeling you should have done more for someone who's gone. Unable to accept Alaska's death as an accident, Miles and the colonel investigate what happened that night. They discover January 9th was the anniversary of her mother's death, a fact Alaska likely remembered while doodling white flowers, identical to those her boyfriend sent her, triggering her breakdown and desperate drive. This provides a bittersweet answer. Alaska probably wasn't suicidal, but her emotional state and intoxication created dangerous conditions. She was rushing to her mother's grave, consumed by guilt for forgetting the anniversary. As the school year continues, Miles and his friends honor Alaska while moving forward. They execute the Alaska Young Memorial Prank, an elaborate scheme featuring a male stripper posing as a psychology professor who delivers an academic speech before stripping to his underwear, shouting, "This one's for Alaska Young." In his final religion essay, Miles concludes that while he'll eventually forget the details of Alaska, she forgives his forgetting. He rejects the notion that we are merely matter to be recycled, believing we are greater than the sum of our parts. What does looking for Alaska ultimately tell us about life, death, and the messy space between? Perhaps it's that we never truly know another person completely. We see only fragments, like Miles saw fragments of Alaska. Or maybe it's that forgiveness of others and ourselves is the only way out of the labyrinth of suffering. The novel ends with Miles and the colonel discussing escape from this labyrinth. The colonel admits that straight and fast, Alaska's way out, still seems like the only way, but he chooses to stay despite how much it blows. Miles doesn't claim to know what happens after death, but believes that wherever there is, it must be beautiful. In the end, Miles finds his great perhaps not in some grand adventure, but in loving and losing Alaska Young. He learns that meaning comes from connection within suffering. The labyrinth may be inescapable, but we don't have to navigate it alone. In its darkest corners, we find moments of beauty that make the journey worthwhile.